Je suis et nous sommes très heureux d'accueillir à Paris Gail Rubin pour une journée qui précède une autre journée qui aura lieu demain à l'invitation d'EPEL, et donc de l'école lacanienne. Mais je vais vous parler de celle d'aujourd'hui, dont le point de départ, ce sont, comme l'indique le titre de la journée, « Féminismes et guerres du sexe », c'est donc une référence à un moment historique particulier et à sa résonance encore aujourd'hui aux États-Unis, mais pas seulement aux États-Unis, et à un moment historique dans lequel l'intervention à la fois militante et théorique de Gail Rubin a été décisive. C'est en particulier donc autour d'un texte, mais aussi autour d'un ensemble de textes, mais un texte qui s'appelle en anglais « Thinking Sex »,« Penser le sexe ». Je reviendrai sur les quelques traductions disponibles des travaux de Gail Rubin. Merci beaucoup. Et en particulier sur cet ouvrage, mais j'y reviens dans un instant. Le titre de la journée, qui est traduit de l'anglais, donc « Sex Wars »,« Guerre du sexe », il correspond d'une part à ce moment historique, mais aussi, pour ma part, il m'importe parce que lorsque j'ai commencé à lire les travaux de Gail Rubin, il y a une bonne vingtaine d'années, et quand j'ai commencé d'en parler en 1994-95, quand j'ai commencé à enseigner en France, après avoir enseigné aux États-Unis, le thème qui était dominant, c'était celui de la guerre des sexes. La guerre des sexes, c'était l'idée que le féminisme introduisait la guerre entre les hommes et les femmes. Et il me paraissait, et je crois qu'il est potentiellement intéressant pour tout le monde ici, d'essayer de déplacer la question qui avait été posée en termes de guerre des sexes pour en faire une autre question qui est celle des guerres du sexe, c'est-à-dire non pas le féminisme contre la société, mais des querelles, des polémiques, des controverses qui divisent, qui déchirent, mais aussi qui structurent le féminisme. Donc, qui permettent de comprendre le féminisme non pas comme un monde unifié, mais comme un champ de bataille. Et c'est important, me semble-t-il, dans le contexte d'aujourd'hui, où on entend parler de la théorie du genre, voire de la théorie du gender, il me paraît important de rappeler que le féminisme n'est pas un monde qui parle d'une seule voix, c'est un monde où la politique n'est pas seulement à l'extérieur, elle est au cœur du féminisme. Ça, c'est pour le texte « Penser le sexe », qui est un texte qui a été publié donc en 1984, qui correspond à un colloque de 1982. On aura l'occasion d'y revenir, et en particulier, Gail Rubin va y revenir dans son exposé. Mais il y avait un texte précédent qui a joué un rôle également décisif dans l'histoire du féminisme aux États-Unis, qui est un texte qui a été publié d'abord en 1975, mais qui avait connu des versions antérieures, alors même que Gail Rubin était étudiante pas encore engagée dans son doctorat, qui est le texte sur le marché aux femmes. Ces deux textes, on les trouve en particulier dans « Surveiller et jouir », donc dans ce recueil, mais le marché aux femmes était disponible depuis longtemps dans une traduction de Nicole Claude Mathieu. Donc le contexte aujourd'hui, me semble-t-il, en France, pour avoir cette conversation, cette journée autour de Gail Rubin, ce sont les guerres du genre, donc, pourrait-on dire, et pas simplement les guerres du sexe, mais il me semble qu'il y a aussi quelque chose comme une « sex panic », qui n'est pas seulement états-unienne, mais qui est aussi française, autour d'un ensemble de questions telles que la prostitution. Nous aurons l'occasion d'y revenir, et en tout cas, pour ma part, j'y reviendrai cet après-midi. Alors, les textes qui sont disponibles en français, donc, outre ce volume, « Surveiller et jouir », qui a été publié en 2010, il y avait déjà un premier volume publié par EPEL quelques années plus tôt, « Marché au sexe », qui rendait disponible à la fois des textes de Gail Rubin, mais aussi de Judith Butler, à un moment où très peu étaient traduits en français, et y compris leurs conversations, leurs échanges. Ce volume, il est rendu possible en particulier par des traductions qui préexistaient pour certaines, mais aussi par des traductions nouvelles de Rostom Mesli, qui a accompagné non seulement cette publication, mais aussi qui a rendu possible la visite d'Egal Rubin en Europe, puisqu'elle vient également de Bruxelles. Donc, à la fois demain, aujourd'hui, l'ensemble de tout cela a été plus que facilité, rendu possible par Rostom Mesli, et donc je lui en suis très reconnaissant. Cette aide n'est pas seulement matérielle, puisqu'il a introduit en français, avec David Halperin, qui est ici, l'ouvrage « Surveiller et jouir », dans un beau texte qui s'appelle « Notre ami, Gail Rubin », entre guillemets. Il y a aussi tout un pan du travail de Gail Rubin qui est présent dans ce volume et qui sera évoqué, me semble-t-il, en particulier cet après-midi dans l'intervention de Mathieu Trachman, à côté de ces deux textes peut-être les plus visibles. Mais il y a aussi tous ces travaux d'ethnographie à proprement parler, puisque Gail Rubin est anthropologue. Et ce sont les travaux d'ethnographie d'une culture ou d'une contre-culture, gay, cuir. Et il me semble que de ce point de vue-là, le rapprochement auquel je songeais, c'était avec Esther Newton et avec ses travaux d'ethnographie pionniers dans le domaine des études gays et lesbiennes. Alors, au moment de conclure, je voudrais juste donner quelques éléments pratique sur l'organisation de la journée. D'abord, rappeler qu'elle est rendue possible par le soutien d'institutions. C'est un des éléments paradoxaux dans notre critique des institutions. Et en particulier, donc, l'IRIS, le laboratoire auquel je suis encore attaché, qui a largement contribué à ce financement, mais aussi le Centre d'études féminines et d'études de genre de Paris 8, auquel je suis également rattaché. Donc, je remercie ces deux institutions d'avoir rendu possible cette journée. Je vous donne un élément pratique, c'est que, premièrement, l'intervention de Gail Rubin va être en anglais, comme le titre l'indique. Deuxièmement, si je vois sur des visages consternés que vous êtes complètement perdus, j'essaierai d'intervenir par une phrase ou deux pour alléger la pression linguistique. Donc de traduire, mais je ne vais pas proposer une vraie traduction, je ne vais pas proposer un vrai résumé qui ralentirait considérablement les choses. Voilà. Et enfin, il y a une contrainte matérielle assez forte, c'est que nous devons nous interrompre un petit peu, enfin, disons, avoir quitté cette salle pour 13 heures, parce qu'il y a un cours à 13 heures, nous reprendrons à 15 heures, bien sûr, mais ça veut dire qu'entre 13 et 15 heures, nous cessons d'exister, en quelque sorte. Donc je préférais vous en prévenir. Voilà, donc je conclus avec ce qui est la première phrase de l'introduction qu'ont rédigé David Halperin et Rostom Mesli pour l'édition française. C'est « Gail Rubin est une légende vivante des études sur la sexualité et la queer theory », j'ajouterais, et des études sur le genre aussi. Et en tout cas, je suis ravi que Gail Rubin vienne nous parler de cette histoire, et on verra que ce n'est pas une histoire seulement du passé, c'est une histoire qui résonne au présent. Donc, thank you very much, Gail, and I will remain silent.
Merci, Eric. Thank you for having me here. Thank you all for coming. I will be speaking in English, and I couldn't follow. My French is very rudimentary, so I don't know what Eric just said. And I hope. Because the context of my work is very U.S.-bound and many small details of feminist politics and LGBTQ politics, I'm going to talk about that, but some of the details may be a little obscure, and I apologize for that. I hope they're not unduly obscure. There's an old joke in the United States about the difference, what is the difference between good girls and bad girls? And the punchline is that good girls go to heaven, bad girls go everywhere. Writing, it seems to me, is a little bit like those apocryphal bad girls. Written work may not go everywhere, but it can go anywhere. And once you publish something, you have no idea where it travels, much less any control over that process. The essay on which I have been asked to reflect today raises all of these issues for me. To my considerable astonishment, it has gotten around. But I have very little direct knowledge of where it has been, how it's been interpreted, or what it's done out in the world since it left my hands almost 30 years ago. The article was published in 1984, so it had to be sent to the publisher sometime in the summer of 1983, so that was almost exactly 3 decades ago. I never expected that the article would be of interest to very many people. Much of the substance seemed far outside the mainstream of either academic or activist constituencies at the time. For example, LGBTQ studies were academically marginal and mostly took place outside of formal university institutions. Sexuality was still largely the domain of medicine and psychiatry and was only in the process of becoming a respectable topic of intellectual inquiry in the humanities and social sciences. The sex wars, did you define sex wars?
Or? Translated.
I'll be getting to them. Anyway, I'll be trying to explain what they were, but in any event, they were raging within feminism, the result of which I had become largely a persona non grata. And I myself considered the piece a preliminary exploration of some issues I was trying to figure out. The subtitle of Thinking Sex was Notes Toward a Radical Theory of Sexuality, and I meant the notes and toward part quite seriously. I considered the piece to be more of a brush-cleaning exercise than a final statement on anything. The initial reception of the paper was very much affected by the poisonous atmosphere created by the early feminist anti-pornography movement in the United States. Those who did not go along with that movement and its assumptions about pornography, sexuality, and sexual variation were treated rather badly. Pushed to the margins of respectable discourse, I had become a kind of intellectual leper. There were times when I almost felt I should be ringing a bell to warn others of the dangers of associating with such a known pariah. But the bell was unnecessary. They all knew that. There were many other feminists who agreed with the substantive critiques of the anti-pornography movement that were articulated by me and others at the time, but they were very afraid of catching the stigma. So they had a tendency to distort our positions as extreme ones while claiming much of the substance of our positions as their own. They would then announce with considerable fanfare that they were making an original contribution to some reasonable middle ground between these ostensible extremes. This was such a common tactic that some of us at the time dubbed it mushy middleism. I'll return to this topic later, but for now, let me just say that the earliest assessments of Thinking Sex tended to rely on mischaracterizations of what I said, and often these were asserted without any textual support. I'll give just one example, which was a 1986 review essay by B. Ruby Rich, the feminist film critic, and in the journal Feminist Studies, she discussed 8 publications, in 2 of which I had lengthy essays. One of the essays was Thinking Sex in the anthology Pleasure and Danger, and now I guess we should turn on the PowerPoint.
Merci.
And the other was an essay called The Leather Menace, which was in an anthology put out by the lesbian SM or sadomasochism group Samoa. In her review of these 8 books, Rich made the following comment about me. She said, More recently, this is the quote from Rich. This is B. Ruby Rich, not Adrian Rich. More recently, the primary theorist of sexuality has been Michel Foucault, who stands quite apart from the repression explosion model to posit a different dynamic based on a free-floating system of powers and desires mediated by institutions and formed by social constructions. Gail Rubin has frequently used Foucault to explicate the construction of sexuality, yet she and other Samoa writers contradict this allegiance by their frequent reliance on the earlier anti-repression model of libidinal release, that is, if it feels good, do it. Since Rich did not provide a single citation to anything I actually wrote in either article, I am at a loss to figure out where I relied upon a model of libidinal release or said anything that could be construed as, if it feels good, do it, with no further qualifications. Had I used such language, I might have said, if it feels good, there had better be good reasons to prevent people from doing it or to punish them with the criminal law or with extra legal sanctions for doing it. And I certainly was calling for a thorough evaluation of the criteria by which some sexual practices and feelings were constituted as criminal, classified as psychiatric diseases, or made to be intensely stigmatizing and discrediting. As for the claim that I relied on a model of libidinal release, Perhaps this is because I did discuss things such as legal repression. But repression has many meanings, and repression in the legal sense is not the same thing as repression in the psychoanalytic sense. And moreover, in both senses of repression, Foucault even stated quite clearly that he was not denying the existence of repression so much as inscribing it in a larger dynamic. And if you want later, I'll read you a couple of passages from The History of Sex where he talks about this. B. Ruby Rich might have taken some statement of mine out of context to come up with this characterization of my arguments as so simplistic and distorted, but she did not even bother to support her claims with any quote or citation. She merely lumped me with, quote, the other Samoa writers, as if our cohabitation in the same anthology was sufficient to make her point. Moreover, I presume from the way she phrased her comment that she was only referring to my article in the Samoa anthology. There's no mention at all of thinking sex in her review. I wish I could say that this review was unusual, but was fairly representative of the early reactions to thinking sex. I would call these misreadings, except that many of those making these claims did not seem to have actually read the essay. Rather, they made assumptions based on a common wisdom of the period that those of us who opposed the anti-porn movement were extremists, mere sexual libertarians, who thought that sex was unproblematic and the royal road to revolution, and who lacked any analysis of social structures and institutions of power. Yet my argument in thinking sex was precisely that sex is a vector of durable inequalities and should be analyzed with all the tools available to social science and critical thought to reveal how it is structured, how its institutions are created, and how those create and maintain or are put into the service of various forms of stratification. Although I feel that many of the misreadings of the essay were driven by fear of political stigmatization, and some undoubtedly were, some misunderstandings may have been facilitated by one of the problems with thinking sex. I have a bad habit of writing essays when I should have written a book. So I have tended to produce big, sprawling articles with complicated agendas when it might have been better to do something more discreet and more focused on a single topic, or else to write a book where the subjects could be addressed more individually, chapter by chapter. Thinking Sex was one of these multi-agenda articles in which I tackled several different issues I was trying to figure out at the time. It was very much a product of that time in my life, in my scholarly work, and in the political context of the United States, and in the feminist and gay activist circles in which I operated. These contributed to its strengths, but also its limitations. And so I wanted to spend most of my time today trying to recreate some of that context to situate the article in its time and place, sort of like seeing a fossil in its matrix. And it's too warm today to wear a tie, but I brought a wonderful tie I was going to wear that has a beautiful fossil of a dinosaur on it. Judy Stacy, who is another feminist from the same era, from my entry into the women's movement. We were all young then, and we're all senior citizens now, and she likes to call us living fossils, so I often feel like an ambulatory dinosaur. Thinking Sex was first published in this book, Carol Vance's 1984 Pleasure and Danger, which was the anthology of papers from the 1982 Barnard Sex Conference, where I had given a version of the paper as a workshop. The Barnard Conference has become famous in large part because it was the occasion of one of the most volcanic battles in the feminist sex wars. What actually happened at Barnard has been widely misunderstood, and I consider the attacks on the conference to have been a particularly repellent episode in what was unfortunately a repetitive pattern of conduct on the part of some anti-porn activists. Some anti-porn partisans preferred to resort to ad feminem attacks and character assassination rather than to debate the substantive issues raised by their claims and agendas. They attempted to read anyone who disagreed with them out of the feminist movement, and they aggressively sabotaged events that did not adhere to their party line. Their conduct left a bitter legacy for feminism, for which they have never been held fully accountable. I had been working on most of the ideas presented at this workshop for several years prior to the conference. I had lectured on them at Berkeley, at UCLA, at UC Santa Cruz, and at a conference that was held in 1979 at the New York Institute for the Humanities to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. In all of these venues, the questions were unremarkable, and the discussions that ensued were typical of academic events. They were spirited and engaged, argumentative yet polite. However, once I had been identified as a public enemy by the early feminist anti-porn activists, my public appearances became occasions for protest against my speaking, not just on pornography, but on any topic at all. The protest against my participation at Barnard generated the most press, but it was neither the first of these occurrences nor the last. They began several years prior to Barnard and continued for more than a decade afterwards. I'm very happy that there were no pickets today. There were some early and relatively mild episodes in the Bay Area in the late 1970s. For example, shortly after the United States publication of Foucault's History of Sexuality, Volume 1, I was scheduled to make a presentation about the book on a panel for an informal study group in Berkeley on Marxist feminism. Several of the members of that group who were involved in the anti-porn movement at the time felt I should not be allowed to speak about Foucault or anything else. After a nasty campaign to have me removed from the panel failed, those opposing my participation simply boycotted the discussion. In another incident, a local group of gay and lesbian leftists imploded over having invited me to participate on a panel discussion on political differences and similarities between lesbians and gay men. This provoked such a conflict within the group that they fell apart and never functioned again. These kinds of situations proliferated and became increasingly vitriolic, nor was I the only target. The list of ostensibly unacceptable feminists expanded over time and eventually included, among many others, Deirdre English, Ellen Willis, Pat Califia, Amber Hollibaugh, Joan Nessel, Dorothy Allison, Carol Vance, Nan Hunter, Alice Eccles, Janice Irvine, Lisa Dugan, Cindy Patton, and a long list of others. While the feminist porn and sex wars comprised some of the background of thinking sex, they were certainly not the only context. Different parts of the essay were conceived throughout the late 1970s and early 1980s and reflected three main developments. The first was the paradigm shifts then taking place within the study of sexuality. The paper was an attempt to synthesize and enthusiastically promote an analytic framework that had emerged in gay history, feminist history, and the history of sexuality in the late 1970s. This is what was then called social construction, which was then a radical notion that human sexual conduct, which had often been assumed to be an unchanging aspect of human nature, varying little over time or in different social environments, was in fact a product of specific historical, cultural, and political conditions. These theoretical interests informed an ethnographic project on which I was then engaged, which studied urban gay men, gay neighborhood formation, and the political economies of sexual location. The second major context did consist of the feminist sex wars, of which the events at Barnard were a part, and in which I was obviously deeply involved, and to which I will shortly return. The third context of significance, which I won't really be talking about today, but it was certainly in my mind and in the essay, was the lurking menace of the socially conservative right, which was then gaining increased influence over the policy apparatus, public discourse, and legal regulation of sexuality in the United States. In 1983, when I was writing the essay, Ronald Reagan had been in office for 3 years. The conservative agendas for family and sexuality were being institutionalized in the federal bureaucracy and introduced as congressional legislation. These were the early signs of an ongoing culture war still raging in the United States, in which the stakes continue to include attacks on women's reproductive and economic autonomy, a push to erode or prevent the acquisition of full citizenship for gay men, lesbians, and transsexuals, and the ongoing crusade to control and punish sexually active young people. I could never understand those feminists who either did not notice what was going on or did not care or naively thought that they could use the right for their own ends. My work was... So the first thing I want to talk about is the shifting paradigms of sexuality, which we called in those days social construction. My work at the time was a product of a broader set of intellectual revolutions in the study of gender and sexuality that were well underway in the 1970s. My work was shaped by the same developments that influenced writers and scholars such as Alan Barrabay, Jonathan Ned Katz, John D'Amelio, Liz Kennedy, Madeline Davis, Joan Nessel, Jim Stickley, Jeffrey Weeks, Estelle Friedman, George Chauncey, Jeffrey Escoffier, Esther Newton, Eric Garber, Martha Vecinas, Martin Duberman, just to name a handful of people working on what would eventually become Gay and Lesbian Studies. This burst of scholarly activity was produced in large part by social movements, feminism and gay liberation, which were then taking place both inside and outside of the academy. The early 1970s were the heady days of the first Berkshire conferences in women's history, the conferences of the Gay Academic Union, and the founding of journals such as Feminist Studies, Signs, and the Journal of Homosexuality. By the mid-1970s, a then-new framework that would eventually be called social construction of sexuality had begun to emerge at the intersections of these political movements with sociology, anthropology, and social history. One of the most important publications was Jeffrey Weeks' 1977 book, Coming Out, Homosexual Politics in Britain from the 19th Century to the Present. Weeks drew on his training in both sociology and history to articulate a framework for gay history, claiming not only that homosexuals had a history, but that homosexuality itself had a history. While I am a huge fan of Foucault's History of Sexuality, Volume 1, I also think it has gotten far too much credit, at least in the United States. I have no idea what happens here. But it has gotten far too much credit for these conceptual innovations. That is, it's been treated as a singular intervention rather than one of many works articulating roughly similar insights at roughly the same time. This paradigm shift happened across a broad swath of researchers more or less simultaneously. Social construction was little more than the application of ordinary social science tools to sexuality and gender. What seemed so radical was in many respects a very conventional set of approaches to an unconventional and rather stigmatized set of topics. Carol Vance often observes, what is most odd is not that social construction theories of sexuality were developed, but rather how long it took. Her point being that issues of gender and sexuality were bastions of naturalistic beliefs that were difficult to dislodge. Social construction cleared away obsolete assumptions, generated new research programs, legitimized new subject areas, and helped situate scholarly work in queer sexualities within the broad terrain of ordinary social science. Despite a great deal of initial controversy and some persistent arguments, the major assumptions of social construction now form the familiar ground upon which most queer scholarship in the United States takes place. So it is easy to forget what the field was like before that paradigm shift, when, among other things, much of gay history was the search for glorious ancestors, male homosexuality and lesbianism were understood to be entirely stable and largely unchanging phenomena, and a similarly universalized heterosexuality functioned as the standard by which all other forms of desire were measured and found lacking. The major questions posed in both the history and anthropology of homosexuality were whether and when same-sex or cross-gender behavior was favored, persecuted, or ignored. But what mostly was thought to vary were these legal regimes, theological structures, and cultural attitudes, while homosexuality itself, like heterosexuality, was treated as transhistorical and invariable. Social construction brought change and variation into the ways we thought about all of these sexualities, homo, hetero, and other. This was a specific intellectual contribution of gay liberation era scholars who did, however, call on previous and current developments within the social sciences, and who also utilized the valuable accumulation of data that had been assembled by homophile era researchers who were operating out of the older frameworks of lesbian and gay history. These data that were assembled by the homophile era researchers were incredibly valuable, and they provided the foundation for social construction to emerge. Homophile era scholars had assembled a substantial archive of same-sex and cross-gender behavior through the ages and across cultures, and their compendia were a starting point for many researchers, including me. Back around 1970, shortly after I had come out as a lesbian, I decided I wanted to read everything I could find on the subject, that is, same-sex or cross-gendered behavior among female-bodied persons. And there wasn't a lot of it to be read. It was actually, today you couldn't do this, but at the time you could actually read most of what was available, at least in English, within the course of about a year. And it was this reading of everything I could find on what was called lesbianism that led me to social construction. The more I read about such conduct in different time periods and cultural contexts, the less these all seemed to belong in quite the same classification, and lesbianism did not seem to be an adequate term for all of it. Some of what was then called lesbian might have been more accurately termed bisexual or transsexual, at least in the time in which I was doing this research, although few of those terms would have been available in the periods about which I was reading. In addition, there were institutions such as same-sex marriage in various cultures that were clearly generated by property relations and which might or might not have had a sexual component, such as woman marriage in some areas. Were these lesbian and gay? Like many of my fellow gay liberation era scholars, it seemed to me that the available data were more intelligible in a social construction framework. Moreover, such an approach was more consistent with other contemporary theoretical and methodological developments in history, sociology, and anthropology. Thus, thinking sex was generated in large part by the excitement of my initial encounters with social construction and was my attempt to work out some of the implications. Social construction has had a really strange trajectory in LGBTQ studies. As my colleague David Halperin noted in his 2002 book, How to Do the History of Homosexuality, quote, the very phrase social construction has come to seem a hopelessly out-of-date formula in queer studies, and the mere invocation of it makes a writer appear backward and unsophisticated. This is true. The mere invocation does do that, and we rarely use the terminology anymore. And I find this discursive marginalization really quite puzzling. Part of why I find it puzzling is that with the exception of a few diehards who think that homosexuality was unchanged and is transhistorical and is essentially the same thing through all of human history, social construction won in the way that natural selection and plate tectonics won. That is, they describe the available data better than their proposed alternatives, such as unchanging species, immobile continents, and transhistorical universal categories of sexual practice. And yet social construction has become something of a dirty word, not often uttered in polite intellectual company. I want to at least question why the term has become so stigmatized when most of us in LGBTQ studies are, in effect, social constructionists. And I think the time has come to rehabilitate the term and interrogate its marginalization. So that was those were some of the more theoretical and methodological issues that I was tackling in Thinking Sex. However, these concerns were, at the time of the publication of the essay, largely overshadowed by its political agendas and by the bitter wars then raging in feminism. So now I want to turn to the sex wars and the conference at which the lecture that would become Thinking Sex became notorious. I call this section Speaking Bitterness. What were the feminist sex wars? These were a series of acrimonious debates that emerged within the American feminist movement, at least in the late 1970s, mid to late 1970s, over issues relating to sexual conduct and sexual representation. In particular, the roles of certain kinds of sexual imagery and behaviors in the creation and the maintenance of male supremacy and their causal relations to violence against women were contested with unusual intensity. While these debates have largely subsided within feminism, they have not disappeared, and they continually affect a variety of other cultural conflicts that erupt on an almost daily basis. Pornography became the major site of these battles, but they included many other topics, including, for example, what was appropriate lesbian sexual behavior, particularly contested were expressions of butch femme roles. Gay male sexual cultures were also were debated, and there were claims, for example, that gay male cruising or bathhouse behavior intrinsically oppressed women. So that was one of the sites of debate. Transsexuality was debated, and transsexuality was thought by some feminists to be intrinsically oppressive to women, most exemplified by a book by Janice Raymond called The Transsexual Empire. The sexuality of the young was also one of the issues at stake, although in some ways in a less focused way in feminism than it became in the society at large. The centrality of pornography spilled over into two closely connected debates. One was about sadomasochism on the one hand, and the other was about prostitution and sex work on the other. Sadomasochism became particularly salient because the anti-pornography analysis was utterly dependent on its interpretation of and condemnation of SM imagery. Few people realize the extent to which the anti-pornography movement was, from its inception, a crusade against SM imagery and conduct. The anti-porn position also was a crusade against and a condemnation of sexual commerce in any form. This implied an implicit and sometimes explicit campaign against prostitution. Indeed, it made perfect sense for kinky feminists and activists working for the rights and better conditions of sex workers to be among the early opponents of the anti-porn analysis, since they could see the implications rather more clearly than many, although many of the critics were not involved in either of these movements and simply saw the anti-porn analysis as conceptually incoherent, empirically challenged, and dangerous. Some of these topics had been previously debated within feminism for years, but I use the term sex wars to refer to those topics about which, in this period, discussion and debate deteriorated into much nastier conflicts. This kind of warfare tore through the women's movement for about a decade, from roughly the mid-1970s to roughly the mid-1980s, although some issues surfaced sooner and many still percolate. But the debates over the status of pornography were the most central, in part because of the fanaticism of many anti-porn activists, and also the fact that they established well-funded organizations to promote their views. Most feminist positions at the time were not represented by organizations. They were just things that people thought or wrote about. But the anti-porn movement generated organizations which were then able to do things like put out newsletters and have membership drives and produce a discourse they had an infrastructure, in other words. Anti-pornography politics surfaced as a volatile flashpoint in the women's movement with the founding of a group in San Francisco called Women Against Violence in Pornography and Media, or WAVEPAM for short, in 1976 and 1977. While WAVEPAM grew out of an earlier movement against media violence, WAVEPAM was something of a mutant in its increasingly single-minded focus on pornography. The earlier organization, there's sort of three main organizations in this movement. The first of them was called Women Against Violence Against Women, which was not an anti-pornography organization. It was an anti-media violence organization, and it was founded some years earlier in Los Angeles. But in a way, it was called WAVEAW. WAVEAW, in effect, begat WAVEPAM, which in effect begat a New York group called Women Against Pornography, or WAP. So those are the three main organizations. But the principles in WAVEAW, that was the first of these organizations, it was the Women Against Violence Against Women, had always distinguished violent imagery in the media from pornography. They focused their critiques and their activism against mainstream imagery, such as advertising and record album covers and billboards, and they were explicitly not an anti-pornography group. They actually thought that targeting pornography was a very bad idea, and they said so. Most were very uneasy with WAVEPAM's new focus, and many of the early WAVEAW activists eventually aligned explicitly with feminist opposition to the anti-pornography movement. I did not know this at the time, but almost every criticism I and others later made against the anti-pornography analysis, if one may call it that, had already been made by their ostensible allies in WAVEAW, the Women Against Violence Against Women. These criticisms and objections included the question of why pornography should be singled out from all other forms of media representation, how to define pornography, an issue that has haunted the movement, and how to protect sexually explicit media valued by feminists, as well as the empirical question of whether or not pornography was intrinsically and characteristically particularly vile and sexist. Also, the alleged causal relationships between pornography and sexual violence and pornography and male supremacy. Also, WAVEAW activists were concerned, as many of us were later, with the perils of engaging the state in regulating sexual materials, particularly in the context of the United States and its history of obscenity legislation and the way that has been used against things such as birth control, contraception, abortion information, not to mention gay and lesbian materials. And the troubling potential of enhancing the influence of anti-feminist social conservatives who were then in an ascendant position in the late 1970s. Pornography in the anti-porn movement was being treated in a completely novel fashion. In other areas of sexism in media, feminists were attempting to reform existing practice and agitating for non-sexist materials. In no case did feminists call for the abolition of the area or domain or genre in question, except for pornography. For example, there were never groups called Women Against Movies, Women Against Television, Women Against Advertising, that's a little more questionable, or Women Against Fiction, even though most film, most television, a lot of advertising, and a great deal of fiction were demonstrably sexist and much of it violent. Unlike any other category of media or representation, pornography alone was treated as beyond feminist salvage. The singularity of this position and its underlying premises have too often been overlooked. The anti-pornography movement was, I like to call it, a conviction in search of an argument. Some of these issues, in other words, people decided pornography was bad before they really had an argument for why it was bad or had any evidence or had assembled evidence for its particularly repulsive qualities. Some of these issues about porn were empirical questions, or should have been. There was plenty of nasty pornography to be found, but the question of how representative it was and the question of whether pornography as a genre contained more sexism or violence than other media, those questions were finessed. This was done mostly in two or three ways. The first was by presenting bad examples, particularly vile and disgusting images that were bound to make people feel this was terrible stuff, and claiming them to be representative, or simply, that was the first, was bias samples. The second was simply by redefining pornography such that it was, by definition, that which was objectionable, sexist, and violent. This was flagrantly circular reasoning, since the conclusion that porn was intrinsically bad was incorporated into the premises that porn was intrinsically bad. Anti-porn activists early on were aware of their lack of evidence and the somewhat incoherent quality of their analysis, and they thought they needed to improve on this. In a recent book on the anti-pornography movement, Carolyn Bronstein notes, quote, "As Wave Pam's work around pornography expanded, it became clear that the organization needed to develop a comprehensive feminist analysis that would explain pornography's particular harms to women. Members of WAVEPAM had not yet worked together to develop a comprehensive theory of violent pornography and its effects. A reader of their newsletter in the early years might have had a hard time understanding exactly why WAVEPAM opposed pornography. Members of WAVEPAM, like most women inside the burgeoning anti-pornography movement, were wrestling with basic questions such as how to define pornography, what differences existed between pornography and erotica, how pornography harmed women and men, and how to identify the best means of controlling it. Others thought no proof was needed. Bronstein quotes Kathy Barry, who was one of the founders of WAVEPAM, insisting that, quote, the causal connections between pornography and sexual violence were perfectly evident to women. We need only to appeal to our own common sense, unquote. Although these arguments were logically weak and empirically challenged, advocates of the anti-porn position like Barry commonly described it or declared it to be self-evident and undebatable. They insisted that opposition to pornography was essential to feminism and that, by definition, a feminist could not dispute the anti-porn position. Those of us who did disagree, this is the third way they pursued their argument, those of us who did disagree were dismissed as not being true feminists or smeared with assertions of promoting violence against women. Anti-porn advocates attacked the character of their critics rather than by addressing the substance of their arguments. Indeed, I often feel that the anti-porn literature provides a textbook case of what philosophers call the informal fallacies. These are theoretically persuasive but logically deficient tactics of debate. The anti-porn literature relied almost entirely on such fallacies in the construction of its claims. These include fallacies of false cause, a failure to demonstrate a claimed causal link, fallacies of hasty generalization, which is essentially biased samples, and begging the question or circular logic, that is, an argument that relies on its own conclusion as a premise. But ad hominem, which is another of the informal fallacies, or in this case, ad feminem, was the usual tactic of choice. This meant challenging the character or credentials of their critics, and it was this process of personal attack and character assassination that I think was most responsible for these conflicts being called the sex wars rather than the sex discussions. Couldn't have a discussion. That was one of the problems. That's why it developed into a war. While this sort of thing had been going on for several years already on the West Coast, where WAPAM was located, most East Coast feminists had no idea of its virulence, and they were about to find out in the spring of 1982 at what came to be called the Barnard Sex Conference. The Barnard Sex Conference, and this book, Pleasure and Danger, was the papers from the conference. The name Barnard Sex Conference is actually a bit of a misnomer. It's a shorthand for the Scholar and the Feminist Nine Toward a Politics of Sexuality. And this was a graphic to illustrate the concept paper, which was called Toward a Politics of Sexuality. And you can see the woman is sort of falling between two beds. Those represent the pleasure and danger of the title of the anthology. The Barnard Sex Conference paper was entitled Toward a Politics of Sexuality. The conference was brought about by a planning committee that included Barnard faculty, graduate students from Columbia University, and many New York feminist intellectuals and activists who responded to an open letter calling for participation. Carol Vance was the academic coordinator of the conference and, of course, the editor of the collection, Pleasure and Danger. She wrote the invitation letter, which was sent to Barnard College faculty, all members of previous scholar and feminist planning committees, and activists and academics who worked on sexuality in the New York area. The planning committee met every 2 weeks for 8 months and functioned as a study group on sexuality. Minutes of the meetings of the planning committee and comments by each member of the group were included in a 72-page booklet, The Diary of a Conference, as was the invitation letter. Like the conference itself, the diary was innovative, ambitious, and fresh. It had been designed by a team of feminist graphic artists and was intended to serve as the program of the conference. So it included the schedule of events and a list of speakers. But it was intended to be more than a program. It was designed to be an archival document, not only of the planning process, but of the day itself. There were even blank pages so attendees could take notes. Each workshop was given a page containing a description of the workshop, a list of the presenters, and often a suggested bibliography. The workshop pages featured faux postcards that were used to list the presenters' credentials. The speakers were asked to send in some kind of graphic that could be used as an image on the front of the postcard, and the image we were told that the image could reference the workshop topic, but in the spirit of the diary, it could also be something personal, or merely something each speaker found meaningful, interesting, visually compelling, or amusing. Plenary speakers for the opening and closing sessions included, and I list these names because there were so many prominent feminists among them at the time. These names may be less familiar to you, I just don't know, but they included Ellen Du Bois, Alice Eccles, Linda Gordon, Amber Hollibaugh, Hortense Spillers, and the poets Hattie Gossett, Cherie Moraga, and Sharon Olds. The afternoon workshops featured diverse topics and presenters, and I thought I would just run through the some of the workshop topics, and you can see these graphics as I go. This was aggression, selfhood, and female sexuality, rethinking psychoanalysis. This was everything you always wanted to know, popular sex literature. This was the defense of sexual restriction by anti-abortion activists. This was one of the workshops on anti-abortion politics at the time. This was the one by Esther Newton and her, who's a lesbian, and her straight friend Shirley Walton. They wanted to talk about butch femme roles for gay and straight women. This was called Beyond the Gay Straight Split: Do Sexual Roles Butch Femme Transcend Sexual Preference? This was class, cultural, and historical influences on sexual identity in the psychotherapeutic relationship. This was sexual purity maintaining class and race boundaries. The myth of the perfect body, age, weight, and disability. Beyond politics, understanding the sexuality of infancy and childhood, and this is one of the few for which there is no graphic, even then. This is Lacan, Language and Desire. Sex and Money, Political Organizing Around Sexual Issues, Politically Correct, Politically Incorrect Sexuality, Pornography and the Construction of a Female Subject. So there was a workshop on porn. I'll talk about that in a minute. This was my workshop, Concepts for a Radical Politics of Sex, and I think I'll take a moment to unpack my postcard, which I spent a lot of time making. On the front was one of my favorite images of boot fetishism from Tom of Finland. On the back, the stamp commemorated thought crimes. The address stated my, so let me see if this is working, the thought crimes stamp, and then the address here, which I don't know how it's showing up on the projection, but that was where I stated my academic affiliation. And then the text was an edited version of one of my favorite passages from The History of Sexuality by Foucault, his comments on resistance, revolution and resistance. And much later, I provided a slightly different edit of the same passage to the person who made one of Foucault's quilts for the Name Project. I should note that this Tom of Finland image was probably the kinkiest part of any workshop, of my workshop, actually. And it was probably the kinkiest thing at Barnard at the conference altogether. As you can see from the rest of the workshops, it was quite a varied program and quite similar to other feminist conferences at the time. And I'll just finish going through the workshops. This was the Forbidden Eroticism and Taboo, Teen Romance, the Sexual Politics of Age Relations, Sexuality and Creativity, a theater workshop, Power, Sexuality, and the Organization of Vision. Okay, so that's the, those are the workshops. And as you can see, they're quite varied and fairly routine, actually. I mean, not routine, but fairly common topics. Nonetheless, the conference was attacked then and has been often portrayed since as a wild celebration of sadomasochism, kinky sex, and pornography. This happened because a small number of anti-pornography activists from New York were outraged by the conference or what they imagined it to be. These antagonists staged a noisy protest outside the conference, distributed leaflets denouncing it as anti-feminist, and thoroughly spooked the Barnard College administration. As Carol Vance has noted, the leaflet itself was a, quote, masterpiece of misinformation that served as a template for subsequent reaction to the conference. The leaflet, along with rumors and distorted newspaper reporting it inspired, depicted a phantom conference restricted to but a few issues that matched the anti-pornographers' tunnel vision concerns about sexuality. That such diversity of thought and experience should be reduced to pornography, SM, and butch femme, the anti-pornographers' counterpart to the new right's unholy trinity of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, is an example of the effective use of symbols to instigate a sex panic. Ironically, the conference's major theme reflected in the workshops, the conference paper, and the resulting anthology was that sexuality for women was both is both a means of pleasure and a source of danger. The book resulting from the conference was called Pleasure and Danger, not All Pleasure All the Time, or If It Feels Good, Do It. To be sure, there was no deference at Barnard to the specific claims of anti-pornography feminism. There was a workshop on pornography, and as noted in the description recorded in the diary, quote, this workshop will situate pornography within the context of a number of other discourses that construct sexual difference in the female subject in similar ways, most notably advertising and dominant cinema. We will also argue that pornography cannot be isolated from a larger critique of the existing symbolic order or from such seemingly diverse structures as the family or the church, unquote. Such nuance was anathema to the leadership of the anti-porn movement, whose ideology situated pornography as the major engine of female subordination and the single most pernicious institution of male supremacy, more important than religion, capitalism, marriage, private property, or the state, much less unequal pay, job discrimination, educational exclusions, lack of legal rights, or mainstream media. Which is one of the reasons a lot of feminists, when they encountered this, thought, what the, you know, what are they talking about? One of the architects of the leaflet and the protest against the conference was Dorchen Lietholt from New York's Women Against Pornography, WAP, which by then had formed. Her response is captured by Susan Brown Miller in her memoir. Susan Brown Miller says, quote, "Then," Dorchen recalls with a shudder, "came the Barnard Conference," unquote. Brown Miller's description of the conference typifies the anti-porn account of it. Quote, "The ninth annual Scholar in the Feminist Conference at Barnard College proclaimed toward a politics of sexuality as its groundbreaking theme. Months of planning by Carol Vance, a Columbia anthropologist, and a team of advisors of her choosing had gone into the day's proceedings, intended to produce a joyful exploration of politically incorrect sexual behavior to counter the fascist and moralistic tendencies of WAP. The bizarre result was a somewhat nervous, somewhat giddy, occasionally tearful exposition of the pleasures of sadomasochism. Not every speaker at Barnard that day addressed SM or butch femme roles. A few invitees read academic papers," unquote. In actuality, none of the 18 workshops specifically focused on SM, and as I said, my postcard was probably the kinkiest thing at the conference, and only one workshop discussed butch femme. And one also did address politically incorrect sex. Although these topics certainly did come up during various discussions, they were hardly the dominant focus. With three workshops, psychotherapy and psychoanalysis got far more attention than SM or butch femme, and abortion rights were more heavily emphasized than either. The common denominator of the workshops was, in fact, people reading academic papers. That's what we did. And poets. There were... What was very unusual was there was a lot more poetry than was common at conferences at the time. The account of the conference promulgated by anti-pornography crusaders had a few grains of reality swirling in a noxious brew of hyperbole and misinformation. Vance did not assemble a group of advisors of her choosing. She had issued an open call to which interested parties had responded. All of this was documented in the diary, but no one saw the diary on the day of the conference because the diary had been confiscated by the panicked Barnard administration. Instead, some 800 attendees arriving at the Barnard gates were confronted by a small group of protesters who wore T-shirts emblazoned with "For a Feminist Sexuality" on the front and "Against SM" on the back. And I think I have the leaflet here. Ah, there we go. There's the leaflet. This was before computers. Everything was done by hand. They were handing out leaflets that accused the conference organizers of endorsing, quote, "the backlash against radical feminism and having," quote, "thrown their support to the very sexual institutions that oppress all women," unquote. The leaflet singled out several participants for special condemnation because of their allegedly unfeminist sexual behaviors or political opinions. I was one, and the others included Dorothy Allison, Joan Nessel, Amber Hollibaugh, and Cherie Moraga. The leaflet also complained about the participation of Brett Harvey because of her involvement with a group called No More Nice Girls. This was a reproductive rights group that the leaflet characterized as, quote, "a group of women writers who publish in the Village Voice and who contend that pornography is liberating," unquote. The leaflet's rationale for this objection to No More Nice Girls appears to have been that one of its founders was Ellen Willis, who did write for the Village Voice and was one of the first feminists publicly to take issue with the anti-pornography analysis. My participation was attacked because of my association with SAMWA, the lesbian SM group from San Francisco. Lietholt would later claim in Off Our Backs, and Off Our Backs was sort of the feminist newspaper of record in those days, that, quote, "we weren't protesting the exclusion of WAP, but of the whole sexual violence part of the movement. It's particularly dangerous when you're including someone like Gail Rubin," unquote. There were actually two contradictory versions of the WAP complaint. The first, as articulated by Susan Brown Miller, was that the Barnard Conference was a blatant celebration of SM and a giddy celebration of pornography. The second complaint was that the perverted agenda was all the more insidious because it was hidden. Lead Holt told a reporter from Off Our Backs that, quote, the bias was so hidden at the Barnard Conference. And she complained that, quote, nowhere in the program were workshop leaders' affiliations with SAMHSA or LSM, which was a New York group called the Lesbian Sex Mafia, given. This complaint bears some scrutiny. Of the almost 40 speakers and workshop leaders, only two were members of either organization. But in any case, of what relevance were such memberships? Should all participants in academic events list all of their recreational, social, and political associations? Should they reveal their electoral party affiliations, their religious memberships, their favorite sports teams, their hobbies? I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan speaking at an academic conference, so I listed my academic affiliation, which was appropriate. Evidently, according to Dorchin, I should have had the decency to wear a scarlet letter or perhaps a black leather triangle so as to be more readily identified. Whether people supported or opposed the conference's aims, this exaggerated and inaccurate characterization promulgated by the leaflet and subsequent press coverage remain to this day the conference's dominant legend. While there were arguments over the conference's legitimacy, these rarely challenge the accuracy of the phantom conference narratives. There are many reasons for the persistence of the conference's image as a venue to celebrate porn and kinky sex, but one was surely the confiscation of the diary. As Vance noted, the unavailability of the diary to registrants on that day made the conference's purpose more vulnerable to distortion. Leaflets were handed out before any papers or presentations were made, and registrants' perceptions of what occurred were colored by the leaflet's inflammatory and sensational charges. By the time the diary was finally republished and provided to participants several weeks later, the outlandish claims and febrile descriptions of the anti-porn contingent's narrative had taken root. And then I was going to basically do an account of the confiscation of the diary, but I'll just summarize quickly because I'm going on too long here. But basically, the week before the conference, anti-porn activists made telephone calls to Barnard College officials and trustees of the college, complaining that the conference was promoting anti-feminist views and had been taken over by sexual perverts. Carol Vance says, lunatic as these claims were, they had a galvanizing effect on the representatives of a sexually conservative women's college. Within days, the president of Barnard interrogated the staff of the Women's Center, scrutinized the program, and concerned about possible reactions of funders to sexual topics and images, confiscated all copies of the conference booklet. And the head of the Women's Center talks about how she went into the president's, she was summoned to the president's office. The president was waving a copy of the diary and saying, this is pornography and it's horrible and it just can't be put out with our name. So they basically confiscated all 1,500 copies. So people that went into this conference, they had no program. They didn't have a list of speakers. They didn't have a list of the workshops. They didn't have the descriptions. They had nothing. There was a threat of a lawsuit, and finally Barnard agreed to republish the diary without the name of the college or the major funding entity that had paid for the conference. And the conference was in April, and the diary was finally mailed out to people in June, long after we had had the conference. It turned out that this was the Barnard imbroglio was only the opening act for a series of similar conflicts. Vance perceptively noted that in the Barnard aftermath, quote, some feminists decried these tactics, but the fact that the people who had deployed them were not totally discredited guaranteed they would be repeated. And indeed, they were. And again, I'll be brief about this, but one of the incidents was in 1986, 4 years later, there was a conference called Feminism, Sexuality, and Power that was sponsored by the five colleges in Western Massachusetts, Amherst, Mount Holyoke, University of Massachusetts, Hampshire, and Smith, I think. And I had been invited to give the keynote lecture on new theories of sexuality, basically on social construction. The organizers experienced something quite different from what they had planned when local anti-porn feminists basically contacted them and raised a ruckus and insisted on being included, having some of them put on panels in the program, they also insisted on having an EndNote address. I was giving the keynote. A week before the conference, I was sent the program, and it had an EndNote by Sheila Jeffries, which explicitly was an attack on me. It was called "The Eroticization of Women's Subordination from Havelock Ellis to Gail Rubin." Here was what Margaret Hunt, who was one of the organizers, said about this in Gay Community News. She said, "More than 100 feminist activists met at Mount Holyoke College for a symposium intended to explore the variety of ideas about the ways that sexual practices are affected by history, culture, and politics. The conference organizers had in mind a broad-based approach to sexuality and power. They planned a program that included a substantial amount of material on the ways race and class intersect with gender in the organization of sexuality, and they took care to represent a variety of erotic lifestyles to avoid the prevalent Western bias of much scholarship on sexuality." That's not what they got. What they got, according to Hunt, was a pitched battle over the question of lesbian SM, an issue that so dominated the conferences to make all other matters fade into the polished neo-Gothic Mount Holyoke woodwork. And Mount Holyoke is one of those colleges that is just, you know, the rooms are all this sort of old oak that's supposed to make them look like Oxford and Cambridge, I guess. The five college conferences, and this college ended up feeling like Barnard Act II, and then in 1993 there was Barnard Act III, which was played out in Australia when several American scholars whose work dealt with sexuality and LGBTQ studies were invited to the Humanities Research Center at the Australian National University. Among the visiting fellows from the U.S. were Henry Abelov, John D'Amelio, Lisa Dugan, David Halperin, Cindy Patton, Carol Vance, Martha Vecinas, and me. And our participation was once again protested by some of the local radical feminists, including Sheila Jeffries, who sent a letter to the university's vice chancellor to protest our presence and attack the HRC for having invited us. Quote from the letter, "Some of the women invited hold what can only be described as anti-feminist positions, and particularly want to protest in the strongest possible terms against the HRC's bias in inviting Gail Rubin, Cindy Patton, and Carol Vance to be conference participants. The work of these women from the U.S. displays a zeal in defense of male supremacist and meanings and values that amounts to an outright anti-feminism." And a few days later, the Sydney Star Observer ran an article with the headline, "ANU denies conferences showcase anti-feminism." Over the years, there have been lots of mini Barnards, and many of those who were involved in the attacks on Barnard and the Five Colleges Conference and the HRC are still actively working in pursuit of the same or closely related goals. They continue to dismiss anyone who disagrees with them as anti-feminist, sadomasochist, or supporters of patriarchal violence. We might hear less about them these days because so many of them have left the women's movement as their arena of action to work instead in the federal government and in international non-governmental organizations where they now describe their target as sex trafficking, to which they bring the same agenda they brought to pornography and which they now hope to codify not just in U.S. law but into international law and policy. And I would say that they describe their target as trafficking, but they define trafficking as prostitution. So my position is that trafficking and prostitution overlap at points, but they're two different things. Trafficking can refer to all sorts of labor, coercive labor, and exploitative situations, whether it's factory work or sex work or domestic work, which is the approach of many anti-trafficking organizations. They're interested in coercion and abuse, whatever the form of work is. And the other position basically defines all prostitution as a form of abuse and trafficking, and they're not particularly interested in factory workers or domestic servants. They're only interested in getting rid of all prostitution. For example, Dortch and Lead helped found the Coalition Against Trafficking Women, which is called CATW, and is the anti-prostitution organization, and has served as its co-director. And Laura Lederer, who's another significant figure from WAPAM, served as senior advisor on trafficking in persons to the Undersecretary of State during the George W. Bush administration. These activists who are working in trafficking conflate trafficking and sex work in much the same way they once conflated violence and pornography. So I want to end with two things. One is the last section is called the myth. The next to the last section is called The Myth of the Missing Middle. One of the most recent publications on feminism and porn came out a few months ago, and it is called simply The Feminist Porn Book. It's a perfectly fine collection, but as I was reading the introduction, I started to grit my teeth as I ran into yet another iteration of one of the most persistent myths about the sex and porn wars. I call this the myth of the missing middle. This myth characterizes the porn debates as having been waged between two extremes, in which the early critics of anti-porn were set up as straw dogs who were supposed to inhabit one of those ostensible extremes. These characterizations of our alleged positions, such as total enthusiasm for all then existing porn, were usually and conveniently made without reference or citations to anything we actually wrote. Then the writer, and there were many who did this, said that she or he was going to express an original position that would provide a reasonable middle ground between these two ostensible extremes. The substantive content of this reasonable middle ground regularly consisted of most of the same points that we, the critics of the anti-porn movement, had already made, and mostly had made in print years before. While this tactic helped preserve the speaker's credibility, it exacerbated the marginalization of those of us who first called out the anti-porn arguments as pernicious bunk. This mythology characterizes the combatants as existing of these two extremes equally in error and proposes that what was missing was this reasonable middle ground, which the speaker, in this case the editors and authors of the feminist porn group, porn book, are going to provide at long last. This version of the story requires mischaracterizing most of those of us who were involved in the early arguments by claiming that we celebrated pornography without qualifications and were critical of porn as we were critical of sexism and other media. It fails to recognize that we made most of these, the first generation of feminist critics of the anti-porn movement, made most of these so-called reasonable middle points back in the late 1970s and early 1980s when the porn debates first ignited. This narrative is recapitulated in the introduction to the feminist porn book, which is then positioned as an intervention that, once again, is positioned as an intervention that redresses a mistake that we are all supposed to have made. This is the part that set my teeth on edge. The editors posit that, quote, "An unfortunate result of the porn wars was the fixing of an anti-porn camp versus a sex-positive pro-porn camp. The nuances and complexities of actual pornographies were lost in the middle. For example, sex-positive thinking does not always accommodate the ways in which women are constrained by sexuality." I'm not sure to whose alleged sex-positive thinking this is supposed to refer, since there are no footnotes to this section. It's very hard to know who they're talking about. The introduction goes on to say that, quote, "For us, sex-positive feminist porn does not mean that sex is always a ribbon-tied box of happiness and joy," unquote. Again, I'm not sure who they were referring to who thinks that sex is a ribbon-tied box of happiness and joy, because, once again, there are no citations. This way of framing the history of debate over pornography within feminism is not uncommon, it's all too common, but it is dead wrong. It distorts history and is unfair to many of the participants in these often bitter disputes, and it misrepresents the contributions of countless individuals who engaged with the anti-porn movement since its inception. This narrative would not be so aggravating had I not experienced myself and seen firsthand the kind of abuse heaped on those who said around 1980 that the anti-porn position was conceptually incoherent, empirically challenged, politically retrograde, and likely to be captured by right-wing social conservatives in the service of anti-feminist agendas. We were called every name in the book, from anti-feminists to Nazis, to pimps of the dupes of the pornographers, pimps, critics of anti-porn orthodoxy, lost jobs and publishing opportunities. Groups and institutions were torn apart over invitations for us to speak, and we were relentlessly and viciously contested in public. Attempts were made to expel us from feminism. Robin Morgan once asked, "How dare we call ourselves feminists?" This was odd, since I didn't know there were criteria for membership in the feminist movement or that Robin Morgan had been appointed pope with powers of excommunication and perhaps exorcism. I could cite chapter and verse from the crowd of early feminist critics of the anti-porn movement who noted that much, if not most, of the then existing porn ranged from boring and ill-produced to sexist and loathsome, and who, around 1980, were already calling for more woman-made, feminist, and generally better and more interesting porn. Moreover, most of us spoke at length about the ways women are constrained sexually and about the various social relations and various social arrangements and inequalities that affect sexual practice in persons. And once again, I'll take you to the cover of the book, Pleasure and Danger. This narrative about the first generation of opponents of the anti-porn movement has been articulated with considerable frequency since the late 1970s. And again, I could cite chapter and verse of people who have used the same rhetorical tactic to position their contributions as a reasonable and entirely original middle ground, while I and others are treated as if we were arguing that all porn was completely fabulous and politically unobjectionable. I get particularly annoyed when we are said to have had some sort of extreme position we never took, and the same points we made almost four decades ago are presented as if they are fresh insights being stated for the very first time. There are many who did this, but a particularly egregious example is a 1985 book by Mariana Valverde called Sex, Power, and Pleasure. She clearly had read Thinking Sex, and she expends a few paragraphs dismissing it. She claims that she's going to present something entirely new, an alternative to what she calls the two extremes apparent in the United States, where she says, quote, the debate among feminists about sexuality has to a large extent degenerated into a shouting match between these two positions. According to Valverde, these two positions are what she calls the sexual pessimist, exemplified by Andrea Dworkin, and the sexual libertarians, those who, according to her, reacted to Dworkin and company by, quote, going to the other extreme and denying the importance of masculine power and other social forces governing sexuality, unquote. She includes me among this group of alleged libertarians who have, quote, fallen into a peculiarly American form of self-delusion which minimizes history and sociology, unquote, and who, quote, neglect historical and sociological analyses in favor of naturalistic assumptions about what sexuality really is. This struck me as rather strange, since so much of Thinking Sex is a peroration on the social, cultural, and historical dimensions of sex. For example, here's just one paragraph I said in 1984 when this was published, quote, it is impossible to think without any clarity about the politics of race or gender as long as these are thought to be biological entities rather than social constructs. Similarly, sexuality is impervious to political analysis as long as it is primarily conceived as a biological phenomenon or as an aspect of individual psychology. Sexuality is as much a human product as our diets, methods of transportation, systems of etiquette, forms of labor, types of entertainment, processes of production, and modes of oppression. Once sex is understood in terms of social analysis and historical understanding, a more realistic politics of sex becomes possible. Given passages such as this, I am not clear on what basis Valverde could claim that I was minimizing sociology and history in favor of naturalistic assumptions about sex. It's possible she could have made a persuasive argument based on my text, but she did not do so. She also introduces with great fanfare two of her major conceptual chess pieces. One she calls, and I quote, the fallacy of essentialism, unquote, and the other she calls the, quote, domino theory of the sexual passions. She approvingly says that a number of feminists have, quote, begun to develop alternative frameworks that avoid the fallacy of essentialism. She then, quote, the two feminists she cites for this critique of essentialism are Audre Lorde and Adrienne Rich. Now, Audre Lorde and Adrienne Rich have made many contributions to feminism, but when I think critique of essentialism, theirs are not the names that spring to mind. In addition, Valverde notes that, quote, we often argue with one another about where to draw the line with respect to sexual conduct. And she goes on to suggest, considering that some desires on the other side of the famous line might be harmless. Rather, she says, they are all tainted by the brush of perversion and corruption. And she even states that feminism, quote, rejects the hierarchy of sexual practices,
unquote, and that, quote, the goal of feminism in the area of sexuality is to establish true sexual pluralism, unquote. One might think that having trashed what she considered my deficiencies in consigning me to the camp of libertarians who do not think historically and consider only consent as a relevant issue for sexuality, Valverde might have cited places of agreement or acknowledged the conceptual and terminological similarities of her text to mine. For those of you who are familiar with Thinking Sex, some of her terminology might sound familiar. True, I had included sexual essentialism as an erroneous axiom rather than as a fallacy. I use the term fallacy for another erroneous axiom, which I call the fallacy of misplaced scale. And I had analyzed what I called the domino theory of sexual peril rather than the domino theory of the passions. And then there is that bit questioning about the need to draw the line between the normal and the perverse, and the call for sexual pluralism, all of which are in Thinking Sex. So Valverde's terminology varied slightly from mine, but to present these as original ideas by changing a word here and there was a little bit like musicians who publish as original a song in which they had changed the minimum number of notes in order to avoid a charge of plagiarism. By failing to credit what I did say and presenting a skewed version of my discussion of sexual consent, I seem to have left out, I was editing this at 3 a.m., and I had some quotes about how she said my only concern about sex was consent, and that consent was the only criteria I thought was relevant to any sexual conduct, which I thought was a misreading of my discussion of the legalities of sexual law. But in any event, I seem to have cut it to paste it somewhere else and forgotten to paste it, so it's not here. In any event, by failing to credit what I did say and presenting a skewed version of what she thinks I said, she positions me as an extremist, and then she can claim that safe middle ground, even though much of what she says consists of not only similar concepts, but similar language. I wish I could say that this tactic was rare, but it was all too common at the time. So I have one more quick point, and then I'll be done. I want to conclude with some comments about the relationship of Thinking Sex to feminism. While the essay has sometimes been interpreted as a rejection of feminism, I saw it as completely within the best traditions of feminist discourse. Unfortunately, as time erodes the details of its context, these conversations, which were once internal to feminism, are often seen as more oppositional than they were ever intended to be. I've been accused of having repudiated feminism, which is completely false, and I've never ceased to be a feminist, nor have I even, as Janet Halley would call it, taken a break from feminism. I made some distinctions in Thinking Sex between gender and sexuality, between feminism and sexual politics, and I consider these to be similar to the distinctions that Max Weber made between class-based stratifications and those based on social hierarchies of rank and prestige. Such class and status hierarchies are overlapping systems that can be and are often mutually reinforcing, but they are not identical, and it is important to be able to analyze and address their distinctive characteristics. Such distinctions would hardly be even noticed with respect to race, for example, or religion. While race and religion are often entangled with class, no one would claim them to be identical. Nevertheless, as my colleague David Halpern has pointed out to me, my distinctions have often been read as first a separation and then a detachment and finally as an antagonism. While I am admittedly hostile to some kinds of feminism, this is hardly a rejection of feminism. I see it actually as a defense of everything I value in feminism. So just to be as clear as possible, I'd like to read a comment from an email David sent me about a year ago in which he stated my intentions better than I could have done myself. He said, "In Thinking Sex, you do not try to separate feminism from sexual politics as much as you argue that the analysis of sexual politics should not be rooted solely through feminism." He goes on to say, "Your work shows a continuing effort to understand the functioning of social stratification by a broadening and multiplication of terms. As an undergraduate, you found the kind of social stratification that was presented as an object of analysis centered on issues of economics and class, and you asked, what if the subordination of women, what if gender, what if kinship could also be understood as a form of social stratification? Then in Thinking Sex, you went on to ask, what if sexuality, what if sexual stigmatization could be viewed as a form of social stratification? Each move involved an enlargement of the frame of analysis, The aim was thus not to jettison feminism or to detach yourself from it, but to take social critique into new territory and to allow for a multiplicity of factors, unquote. And that's exactly right. I'm interested in addition, not rejection. There is no reason to assume that there can only be one theory, one analysis of all problems of society. We can have many theories, not just one. I'm interested in addition and in expanding the field of analysis and multiplying the repertoire of areas that require attention for both analytic clarity and political intervention. I'm interested in durable inequalities in all their forms and how to ameliorate them. And now I'm finally done. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I open the floor to questions without asking one myself, since I have talked before and will talk later. But if you're all silent, I have things to say as well.
I was wondering about, your last story about inequalities and whether you could elaborate on them a little bit, especially with respect to contemporary feminist LGBT queer movements in the U.S., and especially, you cursively talked a little bit about elements of race and ethnicity, and whether you could speak to that, how things changed from the 70s up until now. Thank you.
I'm not sure what it is exactly you want me to address. You said the first part was what? Can use the microphone because it's hard to hear. I'm sorry.
Yes, about inequalities. This is essentially how you ended. Whether you could elaborate a little bit on what exactly you meant. As a bridge, I was talking about racial politics, identity politics, with all its particular difficulties that strike me as being quite parallel to the problems that you faced over the past 30 years.
It's a very general question, so I'll just try to have a couple of comments. One is, I just think there are many different systems of inequality and social stratification, and they don't all come from the same cause. And there's a tendency in the history of critical thought about these issues to think that there has to be one cause from which everything else springs, whether it's capitalism or when early women's liberation formed. It was within the context in the United States of the New Left, in which many people were arguing that all oppression would be resolved with the end of capitalism. Much of what we were trying to say is that, well, maybe not. Maybe we have to address gender as a separate thing that's not just explained by capitalism. Many people responded to that by claiming that gender differences were the first and primary contradiction from which all other problems came. And I just think these are just so stories. They're tales that don't really tell us much. These, I think, are interacting and entangled systems that are not all explained in terms of one another, although we can certainly talk about how they intersect. And certainly, race, I think, is very parallel because one of the courses that I teach is in the history of race theory and how race became a concept. And in fact, I think a lot of the framing of social construction came from the critique of race as a biological entity. There are certainly biological differences, but they don't add up to anything like coherent races, and that's part of how I was trained in my early classes in anthropology, is to be able to distinguish between biological differences and the social categories that we impose upon them. So the history of organizing inequalities around these ostensible racial differences, I think, has its own history and its own dynamics. And I think it's just really difficult to explain any of them in terms of the others, although it's very useful to talk about how they mutually reinforce one another, how they're entangled. But to reduce them to all one identical thing that has the same causes is, I think, a mistake. And that's pretty much been my response for the last, 40 years, not just 30 years, from my early work in early feminism. I don't know if that addresses your question, but I hope it does.
Early in your lecture, you talked about how this sort of sector of anti-porn feminists have sort of failed to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to what a form of accountability might look like to you. And I think this is especially important, like, today in how, you know, the type of activism that is today deemed radical, especially like the AIDS or...
The what?
Like radical activism. Mm-hmm. How it's sort of viewed, especially AIDS-era activism is sort of forgotten today. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how we can sort of resignify that into maybe like a better context or something.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, but I certainly wouldn't equate AIDS activism, radical AIDS activism, mm-hmm. with the anti-porn movement, although the
No, okay. That's not what I'm trying
to do.
That's not
what you're meaning. Okay.
Let's delete the second part. Let's just focus on accountability, actually.
Well, you know, part of the problem is that this kind of political behavior that the anti-porn people engaged in was really quite unusual and repellent, and should have, I think, been more condemned than supported, but a lot of people, you know, thought this was reasonable in the feminist press. There's very little condemnation. What it reminded me of a lot was, you know, as I said, early women's liberation, when I got involved, was part of the New Left, and there were all of these kind of sectarian groups that would, at the time, circa 1970, that thought that they had the exact right line of how to bring down capitalism, imperialism, and the war in Vietnam. And anyone who disagreed with them was the enemy. So they would go into other people's meetings and they would threaten. And first of all, they would go in and there would be a handful of them and they would each stand up and say the same thing. You know, there would be versions of the same line. That was kind of characteristic of what we called sectarians in those days. So you couldn't have an open discussion. You would just have people trying to browbeat you into agreeing with their line. That's why I call the anti-porn thing the party line. It just reminded me so much of some of these groups. The second thing they did was they would try to intimidate and attack and verbally people that they disagreed with, and sometimes they would even threaten physical violence. I was at the University of Michigan at the time, and there were actual sort of violent confrontations between various factions of the New Left. But people condemned this. These kind of sectarian groups did not enjoy kind of universal acclaim or approval. In fact, most of the people within the movement said this was inappropriate behavior. The anti-porn movement and feminism never got that kind of condemnation, and in fact, there were a lot of excuses for their behavior. Oh, well, they just really believe in what they're doing, and their opponents are just as crazy. And none of us ever did what they did. I never went to an anti-porn... I tried to register for an anti-porn conference, and they wouldn't let me. And I leafleted one event, but I never, you know, wrote the authorities and said these people are horrible perverts and you should, you know, throw them out of your campus we just didn't attack them in the same way. And so there really wasn't this sort of equivalent behavior. And I think this narrative of the missing middle and the two extremes tends to act as if everyone, you know, involved in the dispute was acting as badly. And we weren't. And I would maintain that we weren't. And that's what I'm arguing. And I guess I felt the other thing is that their tactics were similar to the kind of, at a much lower level. I mean, they weren't acting with the power of the federal government, but McCarthyism was generally condemned in the United States, the kind of red baiting and personal attacks on people. Although the right is actually now trying to rehabilitate McCarthy, so that's another story. But the consensus is that that kind of behavior is inexcusable. And that consensus never formed around the behavior of these anti-porn tactics. So that's what I'm saying. They really never have been held accountable, in my opinion. Where's the microphone? We have the... Oh, sorry.
Thank you very much for your lecture and also for showing this visual material. I just wanted to comment or ask something about, because I thought that the visual material was absolutely fascinating, mm-hmm. in its relation actually to visual and the representation and visual activism too. And since you're showing not only the postcards, which I found really interesting in thinking about visual activism in the mm-hmm. early 80s, which I think mm-hmm. is fascinating, I'm just thinking about the cover of the book, which mm-hmm. is also fascinating, and you didn't comment upon, but it's pulp, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. like pulp, and it's also something that probably refers to Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think so.
And also the advert, you know, the little advert on the... Well,
that
on the,
was actually added by the... This thing up at the top was just something they put on the book yeah. later that the press to advertise. It wasn't part of the design.
So, Can you comment a bit about it? And also, I want to ask, who chose this cover?
Okay, I can tell
how,
you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there was this little group of activist graphic, feminist graphic artists who did a lot of this material. They designed the diary. They didn't choose the postcards, but they designed the format of the diary. And they told us to send these images. The postcard idea was theirs, as was the diary idea. They also did the cover of Pleasure and Danger. And they also were involved in the heresy sex issue, which was a little earlier in 1981. And they also were involved in a book that came out later called Caught Looking, which was a compendium of writings from, I don't even like to call us pro-porn. I mean, we were anti-anti-porn. You know, we didn't like the anti-porn analysis. We could be critical of porn, but we didn't want to be critical of it in a way that was different from the criticism of, say, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is quite sexist. There's lots of violence in it. So there was this group, and they were just this amazing group of artists who were very involved in a number of these stages of production in the New York City area. Mm-hmm. Carol Vance could tell you more, but two of them I think are still alive, and I don't know what they're doing now. But the graphics themselves were part of what made all this material so controversial, because the graphics were really interesting. And I don't know if you've seen the heresy sex issue, but if you haven't, well, you've seen it. So that was the same crowd, and they did the cover. And I think the cover was just intended to convey visually the ambiguity of and the tensions around female sexuality, of danger and, I mean, it could be excitement, it could be Pandora's box, it could be a problem, you don't know. And that was the point. They also did that picture. Let's see if I can go back to it or find it. This was one of their graphics as well.
Thank you so much for your paper. You described your position as, I think, social constructionist. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the relation of social construction for you to biology. Do you see biology as fixed or immutable? Is unchanging?
Oh, biology is also very complicated, and you know biology is more very. I believe that we have bodies. I'm not one of these people who thinks it's all discourse, which I think is kind of crazy. But you know, we do have bodies. We live in a physical world. But you know, even when it comes to biological sex, the notion that there are these two completely discrete categories of mammalian body is clearly wrong, And there are lots of different levels. I mean, we tend to project our cultural assumptions onto the body, and that's really the point of a social construction, is that we don't encounter whatever is out there in our bodies and in the natural world without the mediation of our moment in time, our historical circumstances, our assumptions, all of the categories we bring to it. So there was Levi-Strauss once described himself as a neo-Kantian without a transcendental subject, and I think in some ways that describes social construction, that you know, there's stuff out there, we don't always know what it is, and our models for a change. I mean, I think a lot about social construction is a kind of social science version of Einstein's theory of relativity. Everything's relational. What you think of as a thing varies quite a bit. We used to think of subatomic particles as little entities. Now we think of them as force fields. Our models for what's out there change quite a lot. And the kind of flexibility and indeterminacy that people criticize a lot of contemporary thought for is really endemic even to physics. So I don't know. You know, physicists tend to think that we're all soft and, you know, don't believe in reality. But in fact, their reality is just as crazy as ours. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does, but I
can't hear you. You've got to get the mic closer.
I'm just wondering, though, if it's possible to talk about this as natural and to see the natural also in terms of a kind of openness.
I'm sorry,
but
is the mic on?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is, but if you can just...
I should talk louder. I'm wondering if it would be also possible, or you would object to the possibility of talking about a concept of nature as open, as changing, as evolving. Why you prefer the term social in terms of talking about this kind of indeterminacy and relational conceptualizing in your work?
I guess I'm not quite grasping the question. Why I prefer social to natural?
Yeah.
I think because natural has been one of these places where ideologically notions of determinacy have been articulated and fixed. I mean, you can see that in the gay marriage debate in the United States. You know, we have this traditional marriage that's supposed to have been there forever. I know the history of marriage is far more complicated, and there's no such thing. This traditional marriage that all the right wing talks about is very new. There was one congressman who just proposed yesterday that kids in public schools be taught proper gender roles and the natural functions of men and women. So the natural has been a place where a lot of notions of inevitability about social relations have been located. I suppose my work has been in that context. But nature, Kinsey said, and I wish I had brought the quote, but he said, nature doesn't deal in discrete categories. The natural world is a continuum in every one of its respects, and it's only the human mind that imposes categories upon it. And I think that's true. The natural world is a much more flexible, variable, and interesting place than a lot of ideology would make it. But gender and sexuality certain arrangements in gender and sexuality tend to be rationalized by locating them as natural. So I think that from early feminism on, I've always been in this position of trying to push against that.
What do you think of the feminist positions that rethink from the position of the natural, which there are some?
There's a lot. Not what I do. It's not the work I'm familiar with, but I know a lot of feminist biologists who are doing all kinds of wonderful work. I'm not up to speed on it. But, there's a lot of wonderful stuff out there.
Thank you. Thank you
so thank
much.
You.